I was between two packs of wolves that were converging on one another. And it was the most extraordinary moment of my life. I think if one moment stands out in recording this stuff, it's being close enough to see the color of their eyes and being able to record them without feeling in danger.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, Executive Director, and today we are in for an acoustic treat. For over 50 years, Bernie Krause has traveled to seven continents to meticulously capture the sounds of the natural world in all its diverse magnificence. In that time, Bernie has collected over 5,000 hours of recordings of natural environments, including 15,000 terrestrial and marine species. Through his work, he's established a new bioacoustic discipline, soundscape ecology, and encouraged us all to have a newfound respect for listening rather than always looking, and given us a vocabulary to describe what we hear. His soundscape installations have been enjoyed all around the world, and fortunately, we are lucky to have one visiting us right now near Boston. Thanks to the Fondation Cartier in Paris, the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem is currently presenting the North American premiere of The Great Animal Orchestra. This amazing immersive audiovisual experience will be on display till May 2022. But before we speak to Bernie about how he got involved in this whole field and why he's dedicated his life to this work, I would like to introduce Jane Winchell, who's co-curator of the Peabody Essex exhibit and director of the museum's natural history, which is part of PEM's Climate and Environment Initiative. So welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
First, Jane, you were pretty instrumental in bringing this exhibit across the Atlantic. So why were you so impressed with it, and how long did it take to orchestrate the transfer of such an installation?
Well, I've been following Bernie Krause's recordings for quite a while. He's a pioneer in the field. And I heard that there was going to be this installation of his recordings in this unique audiovisual experience that was going to be premiering at the Fondation Cartier. And so I got myself over there and was really struck by how memorable the experience was. So it wasn't just the time of being in there and the experience of the specific soundscapes, but the lingering effect of it. And so when I came back, I started making a case for getting it to PEM. And these things can sometimes take a while, but working with Trevor Smith, who was the co-curator here and the director of multisensory for the museum, we together were able to make a strong case, and just so, so delighted and thrilled to have it at PEM.
Well, we're all delighted too. So this is pretty dramatic for an American museum to go out on a limb and have a sound heavy exhibit here in the States. I know Bernie told me it's much more common to have this in Europe or Asia. Was this the product of lateral thinking on your part, or were you just keen to break some new ground, doing something new?
Well, we like to think of ourselves at PEM as a place that really takes on projects that are challenging and push the envelope. That's where transformation happens in our minds. So this was the kind of experience that felt like, yes, it can be hard to describe it, but we felt confident that once people were going to be able to experience it, they'd realize, oh yeah, this was worth, you know, bringing a project over from France during a pandemic, because of course we were opening it and working with the Fondation Cartier and the United Visual Artists at a time that was particularly difficult for international travel.
So personally, what's your favorite part of the installation?
Gosh, you know, I have a very hard time picking out which soundscape, because they are all so unique, which is one of the things that I feel like has made this such an effective installation, is that none of the seven soundscapes is the same or feels the same. Yeah, I don't have a favorite. I just have the feeling of each one bringing me to a different place and a different kind of mood when I'm in there and experiencing it.
Well, actually, we're going to jump across now to California to welcome you, Bernie. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And congratulations on this exhibit. And in fact, on your life's work, which can't be underestimated, vast volume of material that you've been collecting for all of us, for posterity, really. I want to invite the audience to chime in at any point, either with questions or do you have favorite sounds? And are some of those sounds now gone?
There's actually two parts to that question. The first are my favorite sounds. I think my favorite place to record is Alaska because there are so few. There are 730,000 people in an area three times the size of France. So you can really get away from populations and people for long periods of time. It's like Bill McKibben says, when he tries to describe, he was asked once what he meant by wild. And his answer was, wild is a place where you can walk for 2 weeks in any direction and never hit a fence or a road. It's also a place where you don't see forest rangers telling you about the life cycle of a grizzly bear. And last of all, and best, it's a place where there's nothing to buy. And that's what he called wild. So wild is really important. The second part of that question is, I missed it. Go for it. Tell me again, Mary.
Yeah, we're talking about favorite sounds and then have those environments disappeared. Some of those sounds actually, are they gone?
Well, my library consists of about 5,000 hours of material now in 1,100 different habitats. And what's remarkable about this collection is that well over 50% of the recordings that I have come from habitats that no longer exist. Either they're altogether silent or they've been transformed so radically by human endeavor that you can't hear the natural soundscape really anymore in those habitats. That's remarkable. And that's just since 1968. It's a very short span of time. So we're losing living organisms and living environments at that rate.
Over here, we've got quite a lot of different questions. I know your music from the album Gandharva, and I've read your book. How much of the growing natural silence due to the lack of insects as opposed to animals?
Well, insects are animals, and so are we.
Well, maybe talking about amphibians and mammals versus insects.
I think in Germany, there was a report last year that 70% of the insect life is gone. We're losing several different individual species every day. This is called we're in the period of the Anthropocene, which is also a period noted as the sixth extinction. Richard Leakey just died last week, or a couple of weeks ago, and he was one of the leaders of this whole dialogue now about the sixth extinction. The rhinoceros is almost extinct. There are many other kinds of critters that are going extinct as well, whether they're large or small. I mean, we're talking about insects that are microscopic, that are endangered. So it ranges all across the spectrum. I mean, there's no one class of animals that is at issue here. We're all at issue, including us, especially.
A couple of more questions here. Have you ever captured the sound of large glaciers calving?
Yes, not only calving, but also I was up in Alaska at the Hubbard Glacier, which is just east of Yakutat, north of Glacier Bay. And I dropped a hydrophone, an underwater microphone, down a crevasse of the moving mass of the glacier, not the leading edge where the calving takes place, but I dropped it down in a crevasse, which is kind of a deep canyon that's formed by the movement of the glacier, and recorded the whole mass of the glacier moving a few centimeters, you know, an hour. Over this whole mess, and as it was moving, we got the recording of that. And so, yes, we've got a part of the glacier that's never been recorded before.
Another unusual question, I don't know if you answer to this. Do subterranean species communicate through sound? For example, the spotted salamander.
The spotted salamander, every living organism creates a sound signature. So as a matter of fact, there's a fellow at Cambridge who in 2001 wrote a paper about the sound of viruses as they detach themselves from a T cell. And he's actually got the sound of a virus, which is not quite a living organism, but still it is remarkable. So yes, we have, there is no organism that doesn't create a sound. We just have to figure out how to get it.
Well, you surprised me greatly when I was listening to an interview you did. You were talking about the fact that trees actually do sing and that corn, you can hear it growing.
Yeah. Yeah, because corn, if you can think of the structure of the corn, a telescope type of thing, and it squeaks as it grows at night. So it has this kind of, as you're stripping the stalks off corn, you could hear a little squeak. Well, that's what happens with the stalk as it's telescoping and growing at night. So the tree is a little different. We recorded the sound of a cottonwood tree, which had gone through a long period of drought. And what was happening was we drilled a tiny hole about the size of a pencil eraser here, if you can see that, into the tree and inserted a hydrophone of about the same size and got this tapping sound but what was happening with these taps was it was cells that were sucking in air to maintain osmotic pressure. And when the cells dried, because they weren't able to get water anymore because it was part of a drought, when the cells dried and sucked in too much air, they would pop and then form, the dead cells would form the rings around the tree. Well, we got this recording at 2 octaves beyond what you would normally hear on a piano way high up there and slowed it up by a factor of 5. And got these cells popping. And that's what we recorded with the tree. Now, in the xylem and the phloem of the tree, which is in the trunk of the tree, the pathways by which nutrition and water is distributed to the branches and the leaves, this whole system depends on those cells breaking down and causing the rings on the tree to form. So yeah, we got that sound. What happens is because the sound is up at 70 kilohertz, which is way beyond what we can hear. We can hear 20 kilohertz if we have really good hearing. It sounds like a tone, like a very high pitched tone. And insects are drawn to that tone because they know there's going to be sap. And then when the sap comes out, they know that there's going to be birds drawn to the food of the insects on the tree. So it's a whole ecosystem that's established by the fact that these cells are popping and creating this noise.
Amazing. So 2 more here. Speaking of which, of the things we can't hear, we all know that this really affects the ocean in a big time. So Greg has asked, how can we restore and preserve the ocean biophony? Probably the least understood soundscape on the planet, maybe.
Boy, that's a tough question because there's both deep ocean soundscapes and also pelagic, literal ones, which are kind of more coastal and not deep ocean. The ways that we can preserve it is to cut down the noise of these ships, the cavitation that's caused by the rotation of the propellers on these very, very large ships. And also the navies of the world that put out these incredibly loud and destructive sounds that actually have affected whales to the point where they've beached and died. There's a fellow up in Friday Harbor who started this whole thing of marine noise that affects killer whales, a fellow named Ken Balcom, who's been doing a lot of research on that. So yeah, we just have to, excuse the expression, like my wife says, we have to shut the hell up. And be more quiet and figure out ways to do that.
I think we all need less noise, all of us. So you bring up a good question here. You mentioned this word expression, incoherent dissonance of modern living.
Yeah.
An assault on the brain, which I think it is. and overtaking the natural soundtrack so we don't hear these things. So how do we learn to tune out the noise? Because we can't really turn our ears off.
We just have to find, we have to find quiet places and establish quiet places for ourselves. Quiet down the bedrooms where we sleep so that we don't hear televisions through the walls or traffic noise outside. Create neighborhoods that are quieter by, you know, planting vegetation that absorbs sound rather than reflects it. We have to quiet down cars and straight piping motorcycles, you know, which are a big deal with guys who feel very macho and want to express themselves. Same thing with cars that are straight pipes. We just have to cut out all that noise and make it a quieter world. You know, there was a, I tell a story in my book, The Power of Tranquility, about a guy by the name of James Watt, who was Ronald Reagan's Secretary of the Interior in the early 80s. And he defunded the Office of Noise Abatement, which was part of the EPA in America. When asked in 1982 why he did that, he said, well, and this really explains the whole thing kind of, he said, noise is power. And the noisier we are as Americans, the more powerful we appear to be to others.
Oof.
Go figure that. Isn't that great? I mean, it's a great quote.
Pretty grim.
Yeah. And then he shut down the noise, the Office of Noise Abatement, which is still in existence, by the way, but it's now under the Housing and Urban Development Group under HUD.
So you've talked about the pristine loveliness of wildernesses in particularly like Alaska. We've also been to some awfully decimated environments like Chernobyl, which, you know, isn't still not possible to have human inhabitants there. But a lot of nature has returned there, which is kind of eerie in a way. And I've seen the film of the empty power station with these wolves and everything walking around. Does that give you cause for hope?
Well, if we just leave things alone, the natural world has a way of coming back to some kind of vitality. There's a fellow who in 2006 did a recording there of, his name's Peter Kuzak from the UK. And he did a recording of Chernobyl in the springtime. And it's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, every animal you can imagine is expressing itself there. And it's a wonderful, wonderful example of how things can return if we just leave them alone. We don't have to do anything. I mean, sometimes when we do stuff and we plan all this stuff out, we do more harm than if we wouldn't do anything at all.
You talked about another example of that, of the gray ranch on the Mexican border, which...
There was a place that the Nature Conservancy was running. They owned a 500,000 acre ranch, if you can imagine, which is in the panhandle of New Mexico. And it takes up a good share of that whole panhandle. It goes down to the Mexican border. And when we were recording there in the 90s, it was still owned by the Nature Conservancy and run by the Nature Conservancy. They had cut, it was part of the Sonora Chihuahuan Desert transition area. And cattle had been run on it since the Spanish came. With pretty heavy consequences to the environment. But when the Nature Conservancy came in, they cut down a lot of the cattle numbers. And because the population had dropped, the habitat had begun to come back and restore itself. Native plants were beginning to sprout. And it seemed as if for a short time, the conditions were really extraordinary there, that things were beginning to change for the better. I don't know. I haven't been down there in a long time now, and I don't know if that condition was a condition of sale to the next group that purchased that property. I suspect it was, but I don't know what's happening there.
Gosh, I'm torn here. We've got a lot of people asking questions, and we've got some people asking to hear more of your clips. So maybe we should at least play at least one more of your clips. I know we've got an elephant, we've got the baboons. Let's see.
It's about the Zongasanga rainforest.
Yeah, the elephants, yeah.
By the way, this is a group of social sounds that the elephants are expressing. And they've gathered around this, what's called a bai, which is a B-A-I, which is a swamp. These families are able to go there and get salt, which is, it's partly a salt lick as well. And so they get salt from the earth and the water. And this is why they gather there. This whole herd, was maybe 20 animals, has been poached now. It's all gone. Because of people from Cameroon and nearby, the poachers from nearby forests. So a lot of these animals have been poached for ivory. These are great forest elephants. They're really remarkable animals.
You're listening to Cambridge Forum's discussion of The Soundtrack of the World with naturalist and author Bernie Krause talking to us about his current installation at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, The Great Animal Orchestra. The wolves are rather nice, the Algonquin wolves, I think.
Algonquin Park is just north of Toronto, about a few hundred miles north of Toronto. And it's a wonderful park that goes all the way up in Ontario, all the way up to the north. And there are still wolves there. And they are wild and kept wild, and they don't shoot them or hunt them in Algonquin Park. They let them live. And there were two packs, by the way.
I'm not sure I'd like to hear it on my own.
Oh, actually, I was between two packs of wolves that were converging on one another, and it was the most extraordinary moment of my life. I think if one moment stands out in recording this stuff, it's seeing the color of their, being close enough to see the color of their eyes and being able to record them without feeling in danger.
I had wished to go and talk a little bit more about your concerns about the future of the planet, which are deep, and of course we all share them. But at least now we're living in a period in America where at least climate crisis is acknowledged as a real thing and no longer a hoax. I'm not celebrating the fact about the crisis. I'm simply saying it's no longer debatable. So you yourself lived through a terrible wildfire in 2017 in California.
Yeah, we did.
You wrote a remarkable essay about it and you lost everything.
Yeah, we did. If I can read that part, because I think it's really just a section of it. In early October 2017, my wife Catherine and I lost everything in the wildfires that destroyed large areas of Northern California. Gone was our home in Glen Ellen, our dear cats, Seaweed and Barnacle, all of my detailed field journals going back nearly half a century, slides and photos of work in the field, reference books, nearly 70 years of historic correspondence, the wonderful sounding Manuk Papazian guitar that I played at Carnegie Hall as a member of the Weavers, fine art, clothes, furniture. The intensity of the inferno was so great that the refrigerator and the engine of Catherine's car, my wife, melted into unrecognizable puddles of aluminum. And except for us, not one single item that we had amassed over the arc of our lives survived. With no warning from first responders, county or law enforcement agencies, we were mercifully awake at 2:30 in the morning, the 9th of October, when the hillside outside the front door of our house suddenly burst into flame, and we fled Wild Sanctuary, our home of 25 years, for the last time.
Gosh, it's such a moving account. I mean, it's one thing to know that this is going on and that these fires are happening and that the decimation on the ecosystems are occurring across the planet, but to live through it firsthand, I can't imagine. And yet you've kept going, and you managed to keep your recordings digitally on the cloud. Is that right?
Yeah. And the recordings are the archive is saved at the Fondation Cartier in Paris. They have a copy of it.
That's wonderful.
They had a copy of it 6 months before the fire, by the way, because we wanted to get our stuff offshore because of the anti-science and anti-climate position of the U.S. government. So I wanted to make sure we were able to save it. A lot of our friends from EPA and National Science Foundation have got their stuff offshore too. It's like Fahrenheit 451. You know, climate is not a political issue. Every living system on this planet is affected across the board, and there's no escape, not even to Mars. And all of our actions have consequences. And the ways in which these things can be preserved is evident in this piece that I created at the Peabody Essex Museum. And it's something that everybody has to hear, because this is what's possible.
Well, the exhibit is open and it's on till May. So wonderful opportunity for people to indulge themselves, immerse themselves in that experience. Lots more people, lots more questions, but maybe perhaps we will be able to post that whole link to your essay for people to read the whole thing in its entirety.
Sure.
So brilliant on the website. So I would like to thank you for your work, remarkable work of art and science, really, combined. And also thank Jane Winchell from the Peabody Essex.
Thank you so much.
That's
for this.
Wonderful. So maybe we should at least play at least one more of your clips from the exhibit at the Peabody Essex, the Amazon. That's a jaguar we're hearing.
The growl in the background is the jaguar. That's right.
So I don't know how close you have to get to a jaguar to get that.
10 meters in this case.
And that's a whole book on its own, how you got these sounds. So, Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, Mass Cultural Council, and you. So step up if you haven't donated, and sign up to our members list on the website, cambridgeforum.org, where you will find podcasts of this and our other programs. So thank you all again for joining us. Thank you, Bernie. Thank you, Jamie.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much.
See you soon.